Okay, so what we've talked about for the last couple of days mostly is transcription networks and the sort of transcriptional aspects of development. But of course, what really makes a multicellular organism different from other kinds of organisms is they have a whole lot of different kinds of cells that need to talk to each other. And so the other big aspect, I'm not going to be too provocative and say the only interesting thing in developing multicellular organisms, but certainly the other aspect of it that we haven't talked so much about yet is signaling between cells. And so what my talk's going to be about today is kind of the control of signaling between cells and how that's used, the sort of logic and concepts of how that's used to control pattern formation and development in multicellular organisms. So here we just have the kinds of signaling that I'm talking about, and the signals can either be quite long-range signals between cells or they can be very short-range signals. And very often we're talking about signals within a single sheet of cells, within a single monolayer epithelium. But also of course, there's a lot of signaling that happens between layers of cells. And I'm going to talk about both these, really all these kinds of signals one way or another. But this is just really setting up the sort of basic, you know, the basic outline of what I'm talking about by signaling between cells. Now, Lewis asked me to do a sort of introduction to signaling, and that's quite a sort of slightly daunting task, but what it translates to is I'm going to make some fairly sort of provocative ex cathedra statements about how it works, and some of the biologists may sort of jump on me for this. And I hope it'll be obvious when I'm talking about things that I actually know about, and when other times when I'm just sort of making bold statements that I want to sort of set up as kind of the axioms of my talk. And I'll try and point it out, but you know, be aware that some of this is kind of on a sort of broad brushstroke, and I don't want to be challenged on the details. And on other things, it'll be a bit more detailed. So the first thing I'd like to do is I'd like to set up the hypothesis, which I'm not absolutely certain about, but I think it may be true to say that there are two different kinds of intercellular signaling that happen in development. And in truth, of course, there's going to be a continuum between them. There's going to be a spectrum of things. But I think it is quite a valuable concept, and I hope that as I go along, you'll see that there might be some sense to this. And so what I want to distinguish between are intercellular signaling of the kind we've talked quite a lot about so far, which is morphogens, which, as you all know, is extracellular signaling molecules that have a graded activity, and you read off your position in the gradient to develop in a particular along a particular route. And then the other kind of signaling that I'll be talking about more actually is what I'd call sort of inductive signaling or threshold signaling, where really it's just a signaling between two cells or between two groups of cells, and essentially the signal doesn't hold much information in that case. It really is just the point that you've been kicked by your neighbor. I have received a signal from my neighbor, and that's it. And you can see that immediately there are sort of there are some physical differences between these two kinds of signals, in that morphogen signaling are extremely concentration dependent. The whole point is the concentration, the intensity of the signal a cell receives dictates the outcome. And so there's a direct relationship between the signal intensity and the outcome. Alternatively, in this kind of signaling, it's much more of a binary event. A signal is received, the concentration doesn't really matter that much. As long as it gets over some threshold, then the neighboring cell knows that it's been kicked and knows that something has happened to it and that it should respond in some way. And this is going to be one of the sort of this is kind of my rather defensive line, which I'll keep coming back to. And as I was quickly flicking through my slides just now before up in my office, I realized I do sound a bit defensive on this, because I think I say this about four times on four different slides through the talk. But the point is, there's a kind of class system in signaling. And Lewis and morphogen gradients is the absolute pinnacle of that. That is the elite of signaling, and that's what everyone, you know, that's what we like to believe is the kind of clever kind of signaling. And frankly, this kind of stuff is kind of lower class, and it doesn't do very much, and it's kind of boring, and it may even be as bad as hormones or something. But But what I'm going to argue is that that is wrong, and that in fact both these kinds of signals, that you can produce quite interesting complex developmental patterns with just straightforward kicking your neighbor. You don't need to have all that kind of smartness there. And so that's going to be one of the sort of arguments that I'm going to be making throughout this talk, and I'll see whether I've convinced you by the end. Okay. In my lab, the sort of logic or the way we operate or have operated is really to start by identifying the components of a signaling pathway and trying to find as many as possible. So not just the core components, but also the things that regulate them. And the line has basically been that the more one can understand about those components, that feeds through into understanding something about the logic. And so we've started. So it's very much a sort of experimental approach. This it's. We don't do any modeling. We don't sort of stop to think about how it may work in advance. We just try and identify what's there and try and sort of fit it together using genetics and cell biology and biochemistry. And essentially, my talk is going to sort of follow that kind of this kind of pattern. That I'll start each bit of it by telling you about some components, and then I will tell you about how we've sort of revealed what they do, and try and give you some notion of how we see the logic of how the signaling might work. Now, this is one of these sort of bold statements that I'm not really sure that I entirely believe in, but I did write it in a review with John Gurdon last year, and I sort of thought, therefore, I felt on my honor that I ought to put it up again. We thought about this a bit, and I think it's probably largely true, if not completely true, that in developmental signaling, at least the initiation of those signaling events is almost always regulated by ligand availability. So one could sort of imagine in principle that you could, the limiting step could be anywhere along a signaling pathway, from the ligand to the receptor to the transduction pathway to the transcription factors that are triggered by it. And I think it is largely true, but I probably wouldn't want to be pushed further than that, that mostly what you're looking at is the rate limiting step, at least in the initiation of signaling, is the availability of ligand. And I don't really want to sort of talk about that much further, because I don't think I have much to say, except one could sort of go through examples and counterexamples. But I guess it's a sort of something just to bear in mind if one's thinking about how signaling works. The next thing I want to point out is that it's become clear over the last sort of couple of decades how few signal transduction pathways exist in cells. And this is a sort of non-comprehensive, but nevertheless a sort of quite complete list of the various pathways that we know are involved in developmental signaling. And you can sort of see all the usual suspects there. And the point is, of course, is that there are thousands and thousands and thousands of different kinds of cell fate and decisions that cells have to make. And yet they tend to do them using this rather small repertoire of pathways. And what that implies is that it is not the signaling pathway itself that dictates what a cell's going to do, because there's simply not enough of them. And so the logic of how you decide what the outcome of signaling event is going to be must be distinct from what the pathway is that's activated. And, yes? Well, it's just based on sort of experiment, really, that the same usual suspects keep cropping up again and again. So as people look into sort of one developmental system or another experimental system or in a cell or whatever, the usual suspects keep coming up. You can't find new ones. Now, occasionally there are new things, there are new twists, but it's becoming asymptotic, and one could say one is clearly getting close to saturation of understanding them. And of course, then one can also look now through genome sequences and say, are there obvious new sort of things that look like signaling components that we just don't know about? And yes, the answer is, of course, there are some. But it's this sort of feeling that wherever you look, either in a developing fly, which is what I work on, or indeed in any other species, it's the same ones that get used reiteratively in many different contexts of development. So this is just saying that again, that it's the context in which the cells that receive the signal that is important for determining what the outcome is going to be. And one of the places that's been illustrated, I don't really want to dwell on this, but this is some work that I did a long time ago now, which is, so here's a fly eye that we've seen before, principally in Claude's talk. And this is a compound eye, as you learned, and there are many of these little unit eyes, and each one of them is made up of many different cells, of which there are 8 photoreceptors, four lens-secreting cone cells, and then they're all embedded in a lattice of pigment-producing cells. And these cells are completely different from each other. So these are neurons, and these ones aren't, and you know, these produce lens, and these produce pigment. So they're totally different cells. And yet, it became clear that all of them are triggered to differentiate by the same signaling receptor, which is the EGF receptor. And so here you have so over time you have first of all the photoreceptors developing, and then the cone cells, and finally the pigment cells. And what I was able to show is that the same receptor, so SPITS, which is the activating ligand for the fly EGF receptor, would trigger the development of each one of those cells. And if you blocked signaling by using a dominant negative version of the EGF receptor, again you could block each one of those. And so I'm not going to dwell on the detail of this, but the important message was that these three completely different cell types are triggered by the same signal, and the only difference is time. So these cells seem to go through a series of different competencies over time to respond in a given way to that common signal. The receptor is always the same, and the pathway downstream of the receptor is always the same.
Time is important. Space is important too. What its neighbors
are. Yes, space is also important. Absolutely. And I wasn't going to spend a lot of time on this, but in the eye, there's a quite complex sort of geometry. It's essentially concentric rings. So the first ones it starts in a center, and then they grow with time, and as you go out you recruit further and further cells. And actually, if you noticed in that previous slide, you can sort of see that concentric structure. So the R8 is the first cell to develop, and it then induces these cells here, and then they induce these cells here, and then they induce these cells here, so you sort of spread out with time.
But you completely dismiss the strength of the signal, or you could imagine the signal becomes stronger not only in space but also in absolute value as you recruit more cells which start signaling again.
I don't think I could dismiss that. I don't think there is very good evidence. I mean, as you know, there's been a lot of talk over the years about whether different sort of kinetics of signaling, different intensities or timing of signal, the sort of strength of the integrated signal can make a very big difference in the outcome. And I think the evidence isn't very good for that. But I think it is perfectly true that as you go along, the overall signal may get stronger, and that may certainly spreads it further. But it's possible that it also induces a different fate. My hunch is that it probably doesn't, but I certainly couldn't rule it out. Okay, so just to backpedal a bit now, I introduced briefly the EGF receptor there, but I want to just introduce it properly because that is going to be the sort of main focus of my talk. So most of my illustrations are going to be based around EGF receptor signaling in flies. So the EGF receptor, like its mammalian counterparts, is a receptor tyrosine kinase that sits here on the cell surface, and it signals principally through the Ras-MAP kinase signal transduction pathway, which is a well-known signaling pathway, and that leads into the nucleus where it has transcriptional consequences. And what we know is that in flies, this can do many, many different things in different contexts, and throughout development, this receptor is used again and again for different things. So it controls the fate of cells, what they're actually going to become. It controls their ability to survive or die. It controls their proliferation. In some cases, it may control their motility as well. And so, again, this concept of the same pathway doing many things in development. Now, just so on an evolutionary basis, in mammals, there are four related receptors called the ERBB family, of which ERBB1 is actually the EGF receptor, the epidermal growth factor receptor, and 2, 3, and 4 are related molecules. And they are all four of them equally similar to the fly EGF receptor. So like in many cases in flies, we have a single receptor or a single molecule that has diverged into four in mammals. And because they're all equally similar, one can make a fairly good working assumption that the fly one is the evolutionary prototype of the four of them. And so that obviously simplifies things a lot, that we're only talking about one instead of four. Okay, so as well, so I guess what we've heard about in the last 2 days is how important the transcriptional code of the cell is for controlling development. And indeed, large part of what I've told you so far is that it's the state of the cell when it receives the signal, which I think can be translated largely into sort of what the transcription factors are that are primed to be induced by signaling that is responsible for its outcome. So clearly, the transcriptional state of a cell, which is a readout of its developmental history, is absolutely key. But the other thing that I'd like to argue is key, and I think is also obvious from what I've said, and it's kind of blindingly obvious, is that actually getting the control of that signaling is absolutely cardinal. Because if it is so important, if the context of the signal of the cells that receive the signal is so important, then it's absolutely crucial that the signal only comes on in the correct context. So it has to be on at the right cells at the right time and at the right level. And if any of those are wrong, you're going to screw up development. And so I think that, you know, this is the sort of rationale, this is the justification for saying that understanding signaling between cells is as important, I think, as understanding the transcriptional readouts if you want to understand how multicellular organisms, how they develop. And there are sort of three different things that I've put up here. That they, obviously, the signaling needs to be very precise. It also needs to be robust or stable. And thirdly, it has to be versatile. And that last one, which may not be quite so obvious, what I mean by that is that because these signals are reused in so many different cellular contexts, they can't be designed only to work between cells of a given distance or in a given extracellular environment or whatever. They have to be versatile enough that they can be used in different cellular contexts. And so the question is, how do you build into the system the sort of precision, the robustness, and that versatility for being used in different contexts? And really, that's what my lab's been trying to work on over the years. So this is just a sort of slide to show some pretty pictures of different stages of fly development. And I'll be talking about a bit about the egg and a bit about the eye, and not really about the embryo. But the point is the EGF receptor controls development at all stages in fly development, really, in all these multiple contexts. And the sort of, I think, another underlying rationale for what we do is based on the notion that genetics, the powerful thing about starting off with genetics is that it allows you to take a completely unbiased approach to what the answer might be. And it tells you what are the physiologically really significant components of a signaling pathway. So if you do biochemistry, what you can do is it's a very good way of finding out what proteins can interact with each other and which of these protein interactions are direct and so on. And that's very valuable. But it does leave you with the question about how many of these things are physiologically relevant. If you do genetics, you're left with a certain degree of you're left with some uncertainty about how direct things might be. But you do know that if you've knocked out a gene and it disrupts a process, then you know that that gene is normally involved in that process. And so it provides you with this kind of unbiased approach to finding out what the components that really matter are. And that's what we've done. So in all our cases, really, what we've done is we've started with genetics, and we've tried to use various genetic tricks to try and identify things that, within the context of the fly, actually are important for controlling EGF receptor signaling. And so what I want to do now is just introduce a few of these components of the signaling pathway, and then I'll start showing you how they fit together in a couple of different examples. So the first thing I want to introduce are the activating ligands for the EGF receptor. So these are the molecules that are secreted from one cell and actually stimulate or activate the EGF receptor in the receiving cell. And like in mammals, there are multiple ligands for the EGF receptor, and three of them are like the mammalian ligand called TGF-alpha. And what that means is that they have an extracellular domain which is made up of an EGF repeat, hence, you know, the name of the whole system. But they start their life as membrane tethered proteins. So they actually have a transmembrane domain, and they're attached to the cell, to the membrane, to the plasma membrane of a cell that produces them. And we know in really all these cases now, particularly well in the case of Spitz, this ligand here, but also in these other two, we know that in order to become an active ligand, they need to be processed. They need to be proteolytically cleaved away from the cell membrane, and they become a diffusible molecule. And it's only the diffusible molecule that is an active ligand for the receptor. There's a fourth ligand in flies called vein, which I really won't be talking about or hardly at all, which matches the mammalian neuregulin-like ligands, which don't start their life as membrane tethered. They're just secreted proteins. And as well as having an EGF domain, they have another characteristic Ig immunoglobulin motif in them. But I won't really be talking about this much. These are the ones that seem to be principally involved in controlling most aspects of development. So those are the activating ligands.
Why is the protease
is the activating component?
I will talk about that later, but I mean, essentially, all I'm saying here is that we know that the membrane tethered version is not active, and it has to be released in order to be active. So, and that turns out to be really the key control step for the whole pathway. But I'll come back to that later. So the new regulins, they are just a different class of mammalian EGF receptor ligands. So in mammals, so here in flies we have four, and mammals are actually dozens of them if you include different splice variants, and they fall into different classes. And what I'm showing you is in flies they have two of the principal classes that you find in mammals are also present in flies. So the new regulins, which are the secreted ligands, and then the TGF-alpha-like ligands, which are the ones that start their life on the membrane and have to be cleaved from the membrane. Okay, the next component.
All three of these ligands would talk to the same EGFR receptor?
They all talk to the same receptor, but they do so largely in different developmental contexts and different tissues.
And they would be cleaved by the same proteases or different?
The same family of proteases, at least. The truth is we don't know in detail the answer to all those questions. Gherkin is specifically and only used in the germline. Spitz is used in most zygotic development, and there's this newish one that hasn't really been well characterized yet called Keren, which, truth is, we have some guesses about what it might be doing, and it looks like it may be working in some cells where Spitz is working also, but the sort of differences and why you'd have to, we don't really know about yet. But they are all cleaved by the same basic mechanism. But again, it's a family of enzymes that does that.
And presumably they act the same way on the EGF receptor.
As far as we can tell, I mean, you know, an obvious starting point would be maybe these do different things. But as far as we can tell, that is not true. They all seem to act on the same way in the receptor. The only interesting possibility, and I'd say it's only a possibility now, it has been proposed that vein has the ability to stimulate the receptor in a sort of chronic, rather low-level way, as opposed to these ones, which are a more acute, high-level activation. I don't think the evidence for that is very strong yet, but it's an interesting notion. But basically, I think you should see these as all being equivalent. Certainly, these three are essentially equivalent and really only just do the same job in different cellular contexts.
Sorry.
No, it's all right, sure. Well, that's a possibility, and we don't have all the information to be able to completely answer that. But the main answer is that they do the same job but in different tissues. So one of the ways. So if you have a molecule like the EGF receptor that does so many different things, you've got a challenge for your enhancers to turn things on in the right place at the right time, because there are so many different times and places they need to come on. And one of the ways that you can do that is actually to produce three different ligands and make each one have a slightly simpler set of enhancers than having to have one which has the whole works or all encoded in one place. And that seems to be a theme that quite often happens when you get related genes. They may be doing exactly the same thing, but they just may do it in subsets of places. And it could just be a sort of transcriptional efficiency and simplicity. No, absolutely not. No, so each one, I mean, if you knock out each one of these, you will get distinct phenotypes in the animal. Sorry, I should have made that clear. But those phenotypes correspond to which tissue each one works in. So if you knock out this one, you get phenotypes in the oocyte. If you knock out this one, you get phenotypes in the embryo, in the zygotic embryo. This one we're a little less clear about, but we think it'll be in the eye. Doing the complete rescue, no one has done, and it's a bit tricky to do technically. You can certainly show that one will, you can certainly sort of overexpress them all and show that they do exactly the same. If you overexpress them, so if you put them artificially in any particular developmental context, they all behave exactly the same. Yes, it is different. It is different from rescue, but it tells you that they're all basically doing the same job.
Yes.
There's a possibility of sort of different cell biological control as well. Yeah, absolutely. Quite right.
Yeah, I think that one of the complications might be that you don't have all three on the same cell.
Okay, that's a fair point. Thank you. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I've never noticed that. That is definitely a shortcoming of this slide before. No. You're absolutely right. As far as we can tell, you don't usually have all these in the same cell. They're in different cells, and that is. But thank you.
Maybe another additional level of regulation might be that, as somebody pointed out, if they are controlled by different proteins, if you can have a combination of expression of the proteins and expression of the ligand,
yeah, absolutely.
You might have much more.
Absolutely, you can do that. And the truth is, we don't yet have enough detail on how they're controlled by proteases to be sure about that. But it's certainly a possibility. Okay, I now want to introduce another component, which is a molecule we discovered a long time ago called Argos. And I don't want to dwell on it, but there are two key things you need to know about Argos. The first is that it's an inhibitory ligand of the receptor. It's actually structurally related to the activating ligands, but it instead of being able to activate the receptor, it blocks its activation. And the second thing is that the expression of Argos is actually dictated by signaling through the pathway in the first place. So when you get spits turning on the receptor, one of the consequences of that is you start transcribing and producing Argos, the inhibitory ligand, which is then secreted and can turn the whole system off. And as you can see, that produces a negative feedback loop, which has interesting developmental consequences. And I will talk in a while about one of those, but I just want to show you a sort of conceptual view of how that works, or how I think it might work. Here, so this is now completely conceptual, and as my next slide will say, but let me say it now, I just want to point out that everything I'm talking about is based on kind of experiment plus intuition. There's no modeling involved, there's no mathematics involved. I don't want to be taken to task for the sort of potential, you know, mathematical faux pas here, but it's based on just kind of the nose for, you know, whether this feels right or not. And I'm now sufficiently clear about the importance of modeling to know that sometimes counterintuitive solutions are actually the correct ones. So I wouldn't want to be, you know, I want to put that in as a caveat, but I have not done any modeling. This is entirely based on just how I think it works. So here you have a cell that receives this signal, the activating signal spits, and that produces Argos. Now, what I've shown experimentally is that Argos actually has a longer range than spits. So Argos, the inhibitor, can get out further and act further away from the source than spits. And that leads you to all sorts of interesting patterning possibilities. But I think that there's sort of two kinds of things it can do. Is you can imagine this kind of mechanism stabilizing a gradient of spits activity, where you have sort of red, orange, and yellow, and that's stabilized by the interplay between the inhibitory ligands and the activating ligands. What I actually think, and in the examples we've looked at, what actually happens more often is that this turns what would initially be intrinsically a graded signal, because you have your source of spits here, and it, although it's not very diffusive, it does move around a bit. But it converts that initially graded signal into a more binary output, where you have some cells that become red, and these two orange ones presumably will become red, and these guys don't at all. And part of that is due to the fact that, I mean, the way I imagine that working is that it takes a little bit of time. So remember, Argos is expressed only in consequence of spit signaling. And so it takes a bit of time before Argos comes out and starts reaching any kind of threshold level. And in that time, some cells, the ones closest to the source of the activating ligand, can I just finish my sentence, will have become determined and now become refractory to being inhibited any longer. So those ones will now become red cells. The other ones out here which have not yet done that will be ready to be inhibited by Argos. And that's a way I picture of converting a potentially graded signal into a more binary output. Sorry, John.
Receptors turn over when it comes on and off, or what?
The kinetics of binding, it is not irreversible. They both have, we don't know what their affinities are, but they both have sort of, broadly speaking, functionally, as far as I can tell, equivalent kinds of affinities. They both bind, as far as one can tell, to the same site on the receptor. Argos works more than, Argos doesn't just prevent spits from binding, because you can stimulate the receptor in the absence of spits if you just overexpress it, and Argos will inhibit that as well. So we imagine that the way Argos works, and this has been slightly experimentally shown but not very well, is actually to prevent dimerization of these receptors, because these receptors, like so many others, work by dimerizing in order to become active. But we can't say very much more about it than that.
Is there any sign of spatial temporal autoinhibition?
I'm not sure what that means.
Well, I mean, you have the spatial diagram here, but you can imagine that spits binds, Argos is produced, and that deactivates spits binding on that particular cell.
Yes, and I'll come on to an example of that in a few minutes.
Is there much receptor turnover on the wearing scale?
I'm ashamed to say that in flies, that hasn't been looked at as well as it should have been. So in mammalian systems, the EGF receptor is turned over very fast in response to ligand binding. And that is clearly in mammals, that is an important regulatory step. There is some sort of circumstantial evidence to suggest in flies it's less so, but we have not looked at it in any great detail. And it should be said that in mammals, it's only one of that family of four. It's only the EGF receptor itself that does that. The other three don't. And so there may be some justification for the notion that it doesn't happen in flies, but we don't know as much as we ought to about that.
Can I ask a question about the receptor turnover? When it's turned over, it's endocytosis.
Mm-hmm.
Does it continue to signal when it's as a vesicle in the cell?
It can do, yes. So it gets routed either to degradation or continuing to signal. But again, in flies, the truth is we know very little about it. Okay, so this is that caveat that I told you before, which I got in. I put this in case I forgot to say it, and you hadn't challenged me already, but you did. You know, I didn't forget to say it, so I won't say it again. Sorry, were you?
I'm a little bit confused by the logic.
That's what I feared. That's why I was going fast.
The spits is coming, is localized, the signal is.
Yes. Yes. So in the logic here, this is conceptual. This is not. This doesn't represent. You just have a localized source of spits here. So it doesn't diffuse very well. So it only really gets to see these cells.
But the point then is that the amount of Argos being produced is not enough to block.
Well.
Well,
that or because these cells here have, but by the time Argos gets produced, these cells have already become irreversibly committed to a given fate, so they become refractory. Okay. Yeah, I mean, almost certainly they will stop. I mean, they become committed to a given fate. There's, you know, the trigger has been pulled. At that point, the role of the EGF receptor is over. It probably is no longer activated, and then Argos will fade away. But I mean, there are, you know, that is, as I keep saying, conceptual. In a given real context, all sorts of different things might happen. But that's how I picture it in that sort of one-dimensional row of cells. Okay, there's another component I just want to mention now. Well, you know, I keep saying that's a line of cells that I've drawn. It doesn't represent anything. In a given context, you know, yes sometimes, no sometimes. Let me show you the next. I'll show you something about that in a minute, okay? Okay, so the next component I want to introduce is this molecule called Sprouty, again discovered in the same basic route of using genetics to try and identify things that must impinge on EGF receptor signaling. And Sprouty, the intriguing thing about Sprouty is it's also an inhibitor of EGF receptor signaling, and it also participates in a negative feedback loop. So again, its expression is dependent upon signaling through the pathway in the first place, so just like Argos. What's different about it is it's an intracellular molecule, and it's also different because it works to block the signal downstream of the receptor in the common RasMap kinase pathway that is downstream of all receptor tyrosine kinases. And so you can see immediately that that has slightly different effects from Argos, because it is not EGF receptor specific. Once it's been stimulated by signaling through this pathway, or indeed another receptor tyrosine kinase pathway, it in principle can block signaling from other RTKs at the same time. And that clearly would have a different effect from Argos, which is completely EGF receptor specific. Also, the other obvious difference is this will only work in the cell in which it's produced, and it won't diffuse. So now this just shows that, in fact, there's a third one as well that wasn't discovered in my lab. This was discovered in Norbert Perelman's lab called Kekon. And it, too, is another feedback inhibitor of EGF receptor activity. In this case, it's a membrane-spanning protein, so it actually sits in the membrane with the receptor once it's expressed. It's EGF receptor specific, and they've shown that it actually binds directly to the EGF receptor. So what we have here is the genetics has told us, and none of these molecules were discovered as sort of biochemical approaches, but the genetics has told us that there are at least three different feedback inhibitors of the EGF receptor. And each one of them has different properties, so they're not just a sort of fail-safe three things doing the same job. They have different properties based on whether they're secreted or only work on the cell that they're expressed in, whether they're EGF receptor specific or more receptor tyrosine kinase specific, and so on. And this is the only one that's diffusible. And so you can see that, in fact, there is a really important principle of the importance of negative feedback on these signaling pathways for controlling them. And that may not be news to physicists and engineers and things, because negative feedback is an important thing. But it's certainly at the level of intercellular signaling pathways. This is an important principle that has become clear over the last sort of 10 years or so. And in fact, negative feedback goes as the first example of negative feedback in engineering was a water clock that was designed by Ctesibios, who lived in Alexandria at the same time as Euclid and Archimedes. And what he had was this device here is essentially a flotation chamber, which if this chamber fills up too much, it blocks off the supply of water, and if this chamber empties, the supply of water becomes more rapid. And that allows the flow of this flow to be well controlled and uniform, and hence the floating indicator on the clock keeping time. And just to add a sort of contemporary parallel of a kind, a slightly sort of ghoulish contemporary parallel, when the Mongols invaded Baghdad in 1257, which is something that may be about to happen again, they found that 1500 years later that these clocks were still being produced in Baghdad then. Anyway, so that's the earliest example that we know of negative feedback as a sort of engineering principle. But I think it's fairly clear that it's been built into signaling between cells for longer than that. And smart weapons. I think you can tell me more, but I think it's basically built into everything we do these days in engineering. It's one of the sort of key principles. So the sort of summary on negative feedback is that it stabilizes, it can limit in space in the way I was talking about before, and it can lead to pattern formation. And I'm going to show you a more concrete example of that in a minute. Okay, before going on to the next thing, I just need to come back. I just want to introduce one more molecule called rhomboid, which is here in the signal sending cell. And at the end of my talk, I will come back to talk about this in a bit more detail. But all I wanted to say about it is that it, in many ways, seems to be the key activator of EGF receptor signaling, in that it's the only component really from here, from the signal sending cell, right through to the signal receiving cell. It's the only component we know of that is necessary and sufficient, so that if you knock it out, signaling doesn't work. If you express it where it shouldn't be, that's enough to activate signaling. And also, its own expression very precisely prefigures where the receptor is going to be active. And so by those criteria, we knew that rhomboid was a key regulator of EGF receptor signaling. And moreover, using genetic trickery that doesn't matter, we were able very rigorously to show that it works here in this cell, the signal sending cell, not this cell here, the signal receiving cell. And that's all I need to say about rhomboid now, and you'll see why I just wanted to introduce it in a moment. So this is a picture of a Drosophila egg. It's a slightly sort of unconventional view, because it's kind of like the sperm's eye view. It's sort of from front of it is sticking out towards you from the screen. And what you can see, so this is the anterior and this is the dorsal part of it, and you can see these two appendages that stick out of the dorsal anterior, sort of laterally on either side of the midline.
What are they for?
They're respiratory appendages. Oxygen diffuses through them. Now, it had been shown a fair while ago by several labs, but principally Trudy Schuttbach's lab, that EGF receptor activity is responsible for positioning and patterning these two appendages that stick out of the egg. And there were a couple of reasons, which I should tell you in a minute, why we wanted to revisit this and see if we could extend our understanding of it. And so the picture that Trudy and a couple of other people had developed over the years was that, so just to orient you now, we've now turned the egg around, so we have anterior to the left and dorsal uppermost. And here's the oocyte, so this is the actual thing that's going to turn into the embryo eventually. And here's some intercellular space, and it's surrounded completely by a layer of somatic follicle cells, and I've just shown three of them here. And what Trudy had shown was that this is the mechanism by which the dorsal part of the egg was determined was essentially that the oocyte nucleus at some stage in development moves up to one corner of the anterior part of the egg. So it moves up here. And this, in a way that's not entirely clear, leads to a restricted expression of Gherkin, one of those EGF receptor ligands, just in a little patch close to where the oocyte nucleus is. And these overlying follicle cells all express the EGF receptor. And so you have this ligand being expressed here, and that signals to these cells here. And that, in turn, sets up a cascade of events that establishes the dorsal ventral axis of the egg, and we don't need to worry about that, but it's just a signaling event here. Now, the mystery was that other people had shown that rhomboid, now remember rhomboid that I just introduced, this thing that works in the signal-sending cell, was expressed here in the signal-receiving cells. And so that didn't make any sense at all. Now, these experiments were done very rigorously. They were clearly right, and yet there was clearly not making sense in the basic picture. So something had to give. And that was really why we started looking at this, because there was a real paradox about rhomboid here being in the signal-receiving cell, despite the fact that we knew that it worked in the signal-sending cell. The other question was, so what this leads to now, if we turn the egg again, so now that we're just looking down from the dorsal surface and here are these two appendages sticking out, is that what you can see this leads to is a single patch of EGF receptor activity here based around the dorsal midline. And the two dorsal appendages stick out basically to the side of that. And the question was, how does this signaling here lead to these two appendages here? And the obvious model, what sort of I guess we all assumed was right, was essentially a morphogen-like molecule. The model, so that in order to form dorsal appendage, you read values off a gradient which had its high point at the midline and sort of sloped away on either side, and between two values you produce dorsal appendage, and that was kind of the prevailing model. It turns out that wasn't right, and we had no reason to believe that, and we assumed that it was right, but trying to understand this conundrum about why rhomboid was in the wrong cell allowed us to see how this patterning event actually works. So we asked a very simple question, which was, if in all other places in fly development that we've looked at, the role of rhomboid is to somehow activate Spitz, the ligand, then maybe that's what it's doing here as well, despite the fact that there wasn't any evidence at the time that Spitz, that ligand, had any role in this. And so we simply used genetic tricks to remove Spitz from those follicle cells, but not from the oocyte, or from the oocyte and not from the follicle cells. And what we found is that if you remove Spitz from the oocyte but leave it in the follicle cells, everything's perfectly normal, you make a normal looking egg. But if you remove Spitz from the follicle cells but leave it in the oocyte, then you don't get a normal looking egg, you get an egg that looks like this with only a single appendage. And we showed that Spitz was indeed expressed in those follicle cells, but that's neither here nor there, you can take my word for it. So the model that led to was this, that in fact there was a slightly more complicated signaling loop that developed in these eggs. So here is the oocyte, and here is one of those overlying follicle cells, and here is Gherkin, the restricted ligand that is produced in the oocyte in response to the nuclear migration. What happens is that triggers the EGF receptor. That then leads to the expression of rhomboid. Now, Spitz is already in these cells, sitting here in its membrane tethered in active form. The combination of rhomboid and Spitz then allows Spitz to become an active ligand itself, and stimulate the receptor more. So what you have here is a positive feedback loop. It's an amplification process.
How does Gherkin get released?
Gherkin gets released by another molecule that turns out to be related to rhomboid but isn't rhomboid.
You said that rhomboid was required and necessary for
There are several rhomboids, I will come to that, but there are several rhomboids, and that was precisely the paradox that we couldn't cope with, we couldn't understand, which is why we started doing this, because it seemed like rhomboid was just in the wrong place for this all to work. But, so...
You made an argument earlier that actually the role of Argos was to actually allowing signaling in the cell next to the signaling center, because it comes some, gets some time to be produced, but here Spitz is also going to take some time to be produced. We should be conflicting with Argos at that point. So why doesn't...
I think it's different thresholds. I'll show you in a minute how I think it works. Okay. I think it's different thresholds or possibly just different times. They may need different transcriptional activities to turn each one of them on. But I will come back to that. So, and then actually we also know that Gherkin eventually quite quickly goes or stops being able to signal. And so in fact this becomes not just an amplification loop, but also it allows the signal to be sustained for longer than if it was all being triggered by Gherkin. So here we have now, as well as those negative feedback loops that I was talking about before, we have a positive feedback loop where you get an auto-amplification of an initiated signal. Now what's the patterning implication of this? The clue for us was to look at Argos expression. So Argos, remember, was the inhibitor of EGF receptor signaling. And not surprisingly, given what I told you about how the fact that Argos is expressed in response to EGF receptor activity, Argos comes on at the midline, at that dorsal midline, at the place where EGF receptor signaling is highest, because that's how Argos is controlled. And I'm not going to show you all the data, but I just want to take you through to the sort of model at the end. But so this is how we imagine, this is how we think it's now working. So we've gone back now, just to orient you to that first sperm's eye view of the egg with the anterior coming out of the screen at you. And so here you have Gherkin initiating a signaling event in the overlying follicle cells. And that's represented here by a single peak of signaling. That then leads to the rhomboid and Spitz mediated amplification that I talked about. And that, so now you get this increased signaling here, and that's represented here. What that takes you over is a threshold of signal activity that turns on Argos. Now, having turned on Argos here at the highest point, which is at the dorsal midline, here's the inhibitor being turned on at the dorsal midline, and that leads to a dip in signaling at the midline because you now have the inhibitor as well. And what that then leads to is, as you can see, that generates two peaks of signaling from an initial one peak of signaling. So
Argos is short range here?
Argos is short range here. That's right. And
it gets the oocyte also. It turns off the oocyte.
No, the reason the oocyte gets turned off is actually completely different. It's just that there's a great thick layer of goo gets laid down between the oocyte and the follicle cells at that stage.
Is that what controls Argos diffusion?
We have very, very little idea about what can... we can talk about that later. I think it's actually more of a cell biological talk rather than a sort of control logic talk, that. And the truth is we don't really understand it. And as you immediately see, there is a certain degree of sleight of hand here about the range of Argos. But I think I could justify, but perhaps later, the sort of details of why we think that's pretty reasonable, okay? But
I'm also puzzled about your Argos threshold.
Yes.
And why Argos is produced by the bright green cell.
Argos is produced by the bright green cell.
You go down.
Oh, yeah, now that's a very interesting question. I will mention that. That's a very interesting question. Why doesn't this reiterate? Why don't you get this whole... No, you are, because you're saying, well, now why isn't Argos coming on here and splitting these two into two more, for instance? It's worse than that, is it? Okay.
I can't see why the cell next to the Argos isn't making Argos.
Well, it's because, and I mean, at this point here, I mean, don't forget there's time in all this, and, you know, your windows of opportunity, but at this point here, only these cells here at the middle are above the threshold.
But I can't understand why.
it's a sort of transcriptional readout. You require a certain amount of Argos signaling. The evidence for that is that if you remove this amplification step, so if you remove Spitz or rhomboid, you no longer turn on Argos. So that tells you that the initial single peak is not sufficient to turn on Argos. You need to have that amplification step in order to turn on Argos. You, well, the Gherkin starts the whole thing off. You need the Spitz to turn on Argos. Not initially. I mean, I think what is really an interesting question is how come this stops at this point, and why it doesn't just all start up again. I suspect the answer is a rather boring one, which is just it doesn't have time to do that. That sort of development moves on to another stage. But I'm going to talk about that again in a second.
If you take away Argos,
the phenotype is this. Thank you. One of the predictions is that if you take away Argos from that curve, you're going to get a single broad appendage. It's based on the midline, and as you can see, that's indeed what you get. Moreover, what I just wanted to show you here, and this is a bit what you asked me, Nama, before, is that you can actually see this happening. I think this is fairly clear on the screen. Here is we're looking now at a direct readout of MAP kinase activity. So the phosphorylated MAP kinase, which is downstream of the receptor. And we're just looking at the phospho-MAP kinase. And I hope you can see that at an earlier stage in oogenesis, you have a single peak of MAP kinase activity centered around the dorsal midline. And that's just turned through 90 degrees to make it a bit clearer here. And then later in development, looking at it at this view again, you can now see there are twin peaks on either side of the dorsal midline. So what I claim is that this is essentially a machine for generating pattern. And that once you've started the crank, turned the handle here, the regulatory relationships between these molecules leads inevitably, within this sort of cellular context, to the splitting of a single peak of signaling to two peaks of signaling. And I point out this is done without a morphogen anywhere in sight. This is done just by what I would call inductive signaling, the signaling between two cells. Just I've been kicked by my neighbors, but they're sort of locked together in this relationship between both positive and negative feedback loops that lead to this admittedly very simple and very simplified. I've only talked about this in one dimension. No doubt someone's going to point out why are they restricted anteriorly, posteriorly, and that's a different story. But at least in this sort of simple way, I hope I've given you a flavor of how you can generate a pattern using these kind of signals.
Yeah, but, you know, if the way you draw it still... So how many thresholds do you have? I mean, you have the Argos threshold.
Yes.
But is that actually sufficient? Because, you know, you show the light green there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you actually need that light green? I mean, if you just activate EGF receptor in the cells that should produce Argos, so then you really have an on-off.
Mm-hmm.
Is that sufficient to make the appendages? Because that's what you kind of... Because the way you draw it, it's still three thresholds.
Oh, I see. So you're arguing that this is a morph... I don't... I'm not sure. That's an interesting point.
Because if you just... Yeah, no, that's an interesting point. You would have to do...
Mm-hmm.
Turn on Argos in the middle, and you should make two appendages if it's really...
Can we...
Pick your neighbors.
Can we talk about that later? Because I'd quite like to... If you overexpress rhomboid in the follicle cells... Yes, I think what you get, the truth is I can't remember. I think you get something that looks, I better not say, because I truthfully can't remember. Hi. Almost, is there any role for Kekkon, that other inhibitor? Kekkon mutants are almost completely wild type. You have to look very hard to find a phenotype. So I wouldn't really, I mean, not much. I think so, yes. I think it is, yeah. I mean, in tissue culture, in sort of biochemical assays, it is. You can, I just want to say work that's not mine now, and I'm not going to talk, I don't want to dwell on it, because I will be completely unable to support it, but you can represent what I've just told you in a sort of series of reactions like this. So you have Gherkin stimulating the EGF receptor, that sets up these two feedback loops, the positive feedback loop through rhomboid and Spitz, and negative feedback loop through Argos. Gherkin then goes away. And there is some evidence, which I'm not so sure how clear it is, that other ligand vein may also contribute to a positive feedback loop. Now, Stan Schwarzman, who's a theoretical biologist at Princeton now, has modeled this and has sort of done what a lot of you guys know how to do, and I certainly don't know how to do, about extraordinary numbers of differential equations and things to see. Basically, he was intrigued by our model and wanted to test whether, as a sort of mathematician, he believed it. And in order to do so, he had to write 700 differential equations or something. And he came up with what I'm reliably informed is called parameter space here, of a sort of, here's the universe of possible solutions for a model that's based on basically what I've just shown you. And I like this work because he concluded that yes, it was possible, so that was good. But I think there are a couple of interesting things about it. One is that he finds very sharp transitions between different number of solutions will give you different numbers of appendages. So you get these sharp transitions. And in fact, it's true that experimentally you almost never see intermediates between a sort of series. I mean, you see things where the appendages are more or less developed, but you sort of tend to see these integral number of appendages. You can see the difference between a single narrow appendage and a single broad appendage, and that's accounted for in his model. What I think is more intriguing, and I just throw it out to you, is the fact that it turns out that there are some Drosophila species that have four appendages around their egg. And it is obviously a very intriguing possibility that he, in collaboration with Trudy Schuttbach and Siegfried Roth and various people, but not us, are following up, is whether or not this might provide an explanation for how different Drosophila species have different numbers of appendages around their eggs based on this. So here, as you can all see, this is just the width of the signal x on this axis and the intensity of the amplitude of the signal here along this axis. But please don't ask me about this because I really can't tell you more than I have. That's about it. But I do commend you. I do suggest that you go and read his work because I think it's very interesting on this. I don't know. I mean, I've only ever seen a mature egg. I mean, they are looking at that kind of thing, and there are clear predictions about how you would expect it to develop if that was true, and that's precisely what they're looking at. But I'm afraid I have no idea at all. Okay, so I gave you the propaganda on negative feedback. I now just want to do the sort of similar job on positive feedback, because there was this amplification loop in what I just told you. It tends to produce a binary response. It amplifies signals. It can also lead to dangerous instability, which I'll come back to in a second. I just wanted to write here, because I knew I'd forget it and people would feel very hurt if I did, that I'm not trying to argue that this is a sort of a particularly novel idea in biology, because of course transcriptional autoregulation has been around an awfully long time. The notion that genes, transcription factors, stimulate their own expression and that gives you a positive feedback loop. But what I think has been under-recognized is the role of positive feedback at all, but particularly positive feedback perhaps in signaling pathways, in intercellular signaling, and not at the transcriptional level. Now, here is, I mentioned to you that how do I do that? You all know what I'm going to show you, but this is a good movie, for those of you who haven't seen it.
These civil engineers are very comfortable.
So this is a great movie. So this is the Tacoma Narrows Bridge in 1940. And it did this for about 40 minutes, getting worse and worse and worse, until a couple of minutes after that was taken, that's what happened. And there's been quite a lot of debate in the literature about precisely what the engineering principles involved were, but at least there's a plausible school of thought that says this was a rather sort of dramatic example of positive feedback leading to dangerous instability. Biologically, the more significant one is that I want to just highlight is in cancer, where one of the features of the B receptors, the EGF receptor and its family that I've been talking about, is they're very, very implicated in many different kinds of cancer. And in many cases, there's a role of feedback in that, because what happens is you get overactivity of the receptor leading to expression of its own ligand, which then amplifies the whole thing and leads to the whole system going out of control and ultimately cancer. So although positive feedback, I think, has an important role in developmental biology, it has to be kept in check, perhaps by, for instance, those negative feedback loops that I've also shown. This is quite controversial because our host here, I hope he won't be too offended if I want to read this to you. It says, one would think then that there should be lots of feedback mechanisms to ensure reproducibility. And Lewis said, very little feedback at all. One of the most remarkable features about development is the virtual total absence of feedback. And then we go on and they debate it a little further. This is a debate between Lewis and Antonio Garcia Bellido, published in 98. And here he says, there is no feedback in development, nor even in the regulation of developmental genes. If you put extra copies of Bicoid, you make more Bicoid proteins. We've had this debate before, Lewis. I rest my case, basically. But forgive me, but it's irresistible. And I mean, So this is sort of... Well, I now have an explanation. See if you like this at all. So here's that slide I started with about morphogen versus inductive signals. And I think that one of the reasons why you may have dismissed it is because I don't think feedback fits at all well into morphogen signaling. Because the key point about morphogen signaling is you need to have a direct relationship between signal intensity and outcome. Whereas in inductive signaling, you're looking for a binary response. And in fact, the robustness, the digital nature of a feedback signal, I think is a very promising and very desirable consequence. And that is really part of my arguments for saying that these two things really do form two different kinds of signaling that are regulated in different ways. And I just point out, and I'm not sure if this is really true, but it strikes me that signals like the receptor tyrosine kinases, whose transduction pathways are enzymatic cascades, also tend to lose the direct link between the intensity of the input and the output, because you get a huge amplification in an enzyme cascade. Whereas the kind of molecules that tend to be used more in morphogen signaling seem to rely more on pathways that depend on direct protein-protein interactions rather than enzymatic activity.
So if you think about signaling pathways, if you took DTP, which has a receptor on the surface of the cell,
mm-hmm. Precisely.
Whereas
EGF receptor wouldn't be, because you go through a cascade of at least four different enzymes that all amplify each other, and it's going to be very hard to tie the direct intensity of signals to the intensity of stimulation in the nucleus. Well, there is a phosphorylation, but there is only one. You know, there's one basically. It's the serine. It's the at the receptor itself is a serine-threonine kinase. Yes, it phosphorylates MAD, that's right. So that you do get, I mean, I have put more dependent, and, you know, I'm not going to claim here that there's any direct thing, but I think it is quite striking that the molecules that tend to work as morphogens do seem to fit the pathways where you rely less on a sequential cascade of enzymes, which is where you get the really massive amplification. That's true. So it's clearly not going to be absolutely direct. But I stand by this as a sort of interesting notion, at least, to think about. And certainly I would, in bigger writing, I would defend this feedback issue, and I would think that may be why people like Lewis and John Gurdon, people who work on morphogens, have underappreciated, in my view, the role of feedback. And it was only when one started looking at these other pathways that it became more clear. At a global developmental level. I think that was a rather cheap joke on my part, no. And I apologize, but...
All publicity is good.
Well, I thought, I sort of knew that's what you'd think, so I knew that's why I could get away with it.
I would agree that both that morphogen gradient should have fewer amplification steps, because you can maintain more linearity and thresholds at multiple levels, whereas when you have a lot of amplification, you tend to get a yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, for morphogen gradients, where the exact level of the signal seems to be very important. I would rather tend to say that you need stabilization of those levels in between.
Well, after having heard your talk and, you know, and thought about this more, I added that question mark. For that very reason, because I think that, you know, positive feedback and the kind of digitalization of a signal does not fit at all, but the stabilization that that negative feedback implies actually is quite attractive in a morphogen. And I think it's perfect. I'm not aware of any examples where we really know that happens, but I do agree it's quite an attractive prospect.
Is it more a question of where your feedback occurs? In a certain sense, maybe for this system, what's really crucial is that you have a particular gradient. What's crucial is the ligand concentration. So you can have, if it's functioning as a ligand, then you might want to control its distribution, you might want to control its synthesis, you might want to control all processes
upstream
above the receptor, and have your negative feedbacks and positive feedbacks
working. You could certainly do that, yes.
Hopefully in shape of a gradient.
The key thing is the link between the ultimate concentration of ligand and the final readout, and that has to be maintained in a sort of, if not simply linear, but at least in some sort of proportional relationship, I think.
The switch
doesn't, and ideally you want to flop completely one way. Well, to jump to Lewis's defense, if I had taken that slightly more in context, there was other discussion about how there are sort of correcting mechanisms later on that come to stabilize and correct the abnormalities that would otherwise be caused, which is why he's absolutely right in pointing out that he wasn't really talking about the level of a single signaling molecule. I think he was talking more at the level of a whole sort of developing system. I couldn't resist, though, like I keep saying.
But Matthew, I mean, there's no, I mean, for example, FGF signaling in vertebrates, there's a clear case that different levels of FGF give you different readouts.
Yes.
Yes.
So no, I'm
only talking about lefty as a negative feedback.
Yeah. Lefty is a TGF beta. I mean, it's a TGF beta family, so it is not one that goes through multiple. Oh, I see. I'm well aware of these examples, right? And so, which is why I don't want to, you know, I've added question marks and stuff. I nevertheless continue to believe that there is a sort of fundamental thing here about the requirement for this direct relationship and the fact that this is a sort of binary switch, which allows feedback to play more of a prominent role in this kind of thing than this. But I absolutely don't want to give the impression that I'm saying this is an all or nothing thing, because you've just cited two good examples which would run counter to that, and, you know, I'm aware of them both.
You know, Venus induces nodes, and I mean, I think there's something to it, but especially the extracellular versus intracellular, which is like...
That's right, that's what Eric was saying, yes, precisely.
That might be a good point.
Is there any evidence that the transcriptional readout for these inductive systems is perhaps more simple or sloppy than the readout for the dorsal gradient that we heard about from Levine, in that the signal has been pre-processed and somewhat evened out, that it gets ultimately presented to
you? I don't know. I mean, in principle, you could imagine it might do. The truth is, I don't know.
So are you saying that the fact that you get a binary type of response is evidence that there must be some sort of positive feedback? The reason I'm asking
no.
is because you could have some sort of ultra-sensitive
Absolutely.
Response.
No, I'm not at all. I'm just saying that these do tend to be binary responses, and that tends to be... And that is consistent with having positive feedback. Oh, absolutely. Please don't think that I'm arguing that positive feedback is unnecessary.
So one way you could actually experiment and try to check is to try to see if there's some hysteresis going on as you move your signal slowly one way or the other, kind of things that you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Have you tried in this particular experiment? Because that would be fairly clear evidence as to whether it is indeed an effect of positive feedback or it is.
These tend to be fairly robust. If you mess around with, I mean, I'll talk about this in a second, okay? But I mean, I think that's an interesting notion. Okay, this is just me being defensive again, but I hope I've made the case that, you know, inductive signals can lead to quite complex pattern formation as well as morphogens. Here's an English biologist of the middle of the last century called Conrad Waddington, who wrote about a process called what he called canalization, which is essentially this notion that development is robust against perturbation, and also that you tend to get all or nothing responses and there are no halfway points. And he drew this in all sorts of fanciful ways to do with sort of valleys in landscapes and things. And here you have two cells at the beginning of embryogenesis, and they tend to fall down valleys and go one way or another and not in between them. And people have come back to canalization a bit, and the sort of robustness of it, which is your sort of hysteresis about sort of tweaking things a bit. And what they tend to talk about is in terms of gene duplication and the fact that there are many ways of doing the same job, and that builds in this kind of robustness. But actually, I think it's very striking that these two different properties of canalization fit kind of neatly with negative feedback and positive feedback, that you have this sort of stabilizing abilities of negative feedback and the sort of digitalization of or the production of binary signals from positive feedback. And I just think that it's kind of an interesting prospect that this notion that the animal is surprisingly reproducible and there's a surprisingly similar, the wild type state is surprisingly similar in all animals. They all look basically the same from a given species within a small number of constraints. At least when you get down to the signaling level, I think that probably reflects feedback as much as it does this notion of gene duplication and kind of redundancy, or not redundancy, but kind of overlapping functions. I couldn't resist just putting this in too. So this is whether feedback in development is sort of is now acceptable and no longer kind of outrageous. So, you know, here you are in around 1990, it starts to take off, and who knows where it'll be over the years.
You should do the
art. Okay. I have two more brief things I want to talk about. They won't take very long. We started late. Are people happy?
We started late. I think we'll be quite long.
Are people happy? I wasn't going to do the eye at all, but Boris asked me about it, and I'm not going to talk about it in any great detail. It's just one thing I want to point out in the eye. So the eye, I've worked a lot on the eye over the years, and one of the things my lab has found is that the EGF receptor does basically everything you name it in the eye. So any aspect of eye development, the EGF receptor seems to be involved, and it's been very hard to sort of tease these apart. And because there's sort of these continuous roles for this one pathway. But the one thing I want to talk about is, in a way, I think the most sort of striking patterning of the eye at all, which is the fact that you get this unbelievably regular array of facets. So here, again, you've seen this several times now in this meeting, is a picture of a fly eye. And just look how people have referred to it as being crystalline, and you can sort of see why. And you get this fantastic hexagonal packing, and it is absolutely perfect. And the question, how is that established in the first place? And the way that's established, so now I just need to just tell you a tiny bit about how the eye develops. This is in the third larval instar. This is a developing eye in the third larval instar. And there's essentially a wave of development that sweeps from the posterior of the disc across to the anterior of the disc. And it, over a couple of days, it sweeps across the disc like this. And it's the front of that wave is marked by a structure called the morphogenetic furrow, and that's where the action really is, certainly this action, for developing this crystalline lattice. And so here, this is lifted by from a paper, a review by Nick Baker, and this is just stained here to show you where the morphogenetic furrow is, the front of this wave. So what you have is a wave moving in this direction. The developing ommatidia here are fairly immature. The ones further back here are more mature because they've had longer since the wave passed them. The array is produced by two bits of information in at 90 degrees to each other. So the first thing is you have this movement. So essentially, the first is simply the movement of the wave across the disk, and that gives you information in one dimension. So, and then the second dimension comes, here's the furrow again, it comes out of the spacing of the cells These are the R8 cells that initiate each one of these omatidia, and these have to be spaced horizontally along the morphogenetic furrow, I guess vertically in this picture, but you know what I mean. And the combination of a wave moving in this direction and spacing these in this direction gives you this essential hexagonal array that leads eventually to this packing. And so the question is, how do you go from a morphogenetic furrow to these spaced out R8s? Sorry? So the way Nick's drawn this is he's just showing the R8s, and this is basically the birth of the R8s. And what happens here is that, well, what he's actually showing is cells that are positive for atonal, the transcription factor that specifies R8, and you get a narrowing down process. So what happens is that you start at the furrow with all cells expressing atonal, and then then it begins to narrow down into these little kind of valleys between the sort of peaks and valleys in the stripe of atonal, and eventually that narrows down to a single cell expressing atonal. By the time you get to there, you could argue that the action is all over for developing this lattice, because by that stage you now get this regularly spaced out array of R8s, and each one of those is going to be the seed for a whole omatidium. And that's shown in sort of all its gory biological unpleasantness here. This is, you know, here it is all sort of beautiful and laid out. This is actually what it looks like. But what we're looking at here is, again, atonal. This is the transcription factor that specifies R8, which is going to seed each one of these omatidia. And you can see that what happens is that it starts its life as being completely uniform, and then you start seeing these kind of bumps and indentations into it, which are shown much more cleanly and nicely here. And then eventually you get to these single R8s. Now, to be honest, the exact details of how that works is still a bit controversial, and the precise sort of role, the relative role of different players isn't entirely determined, and we have our own view and other people have their own view, and I'm just going to show you our view. But
the time scale
is that each row or column, whatever you want to call it, each new row is effectively 2 hours. It takes about 2 days to go from here to, for the furrow to traverse the whole disk. Yes. No, here this would represent longer. So these cells will probably express it. So there's probably 3 or 4 rows here. So these might express it for 8 or 10 hours. That's right. It takes longer before, probably because there are other factors involved as well. All I really want to talk about now is the actual just singling out process to make this array, because as I say, I think that's where the action is for setting up this pattern.
I didn't understand something. On the right-hand side of this lower figure,
yes.
What caused the vertical staggering? Perhaps you
explain that. I'm going to explain that, because that is key, because the other point is, not only are they irregular, but thanks for making that clear now, not only are they irregular, but each new row is 180 degrees out of phase with the other one. And of course, if you want to make a hexagonal array, that's what you need to do. Okay, so this is, I think all groups would agree on the general principles of this. I just grabbed this out of a PDF, it's a bit fuzzy, but I think people would dispute some of the details, but I really only care about the principle here, about how it works. I don't want to talk about how it kicks off in the first place. Of course, that's very interesting. I just wanted to consider a sort of furrow halfway along the disk. So here are already forming omatidia. Here's the R8 cell, it's already recruited the 2 and 5 photoreceptors. It produces a signal, hedgehog, which is a diffusible signal, and it diffuses ahead of itself to a place just ahead of the morphogenetic furrow, which is about here, and switches on atonal. So atonal is now switched on uniformly by hedgehog diffusing forwards, and that switches on atonal. So you get a broad band of atonal that you saw before. That band now starts being modulated by the activity of an inhibitor that is produced by the slightly more mature clusters of atonal that are beginning to narrow down to one cell. And that is an EGF receptor-dependent event. So what you have is you have here atonal in these things. So imagine this cluster here. This is what's going on. Atonal activates through rhomboid and Spitz. It activates the EGF receptor, which itself then activates an unknown inhibitory molecule, which leads to the inhibition of atonal at a distance. And so what you can see here is you have basically an inhibitory zone around each one of these clusters. And this zone touches here and here this stripe of atonal and begins to turn it off. but allows here at the more distant point, the point of greatest distance between these two clusters, which is here, it allows atonal to be maintained. Atonal then kicks on an autoregulatory positive feedback loop to maintain its own expression within these clusters. And then these clusters then get narrowed down still further by notch and delta lateral inhibition, which is another mechanism that I don't want to discuss, but is a well-known mechanism for singling out a single cell from a group of cells. But the actual symmetry breaking event, the point that goes from a uniform band of cells to this array that will ultimately turn into the neat array of R8s, is this inhibitory zone that is induced by EGF receptor activity. And that leads, as I say, to this process, which is then tightened up by positive feedback, by the atonal positive feedback loop, the autoregulatory loop of atonal, and then you have this notch delta lateral inhibition, and eventually you make your single line of R8s, which then seed the omatidia. And so there are other molecules involved. I talked about notch and delta. Scabrous is another inhibitor. We're not entirely sure how that fits in with this. But this is basically a self-organizing thing once the whole thing is kicked off. Because as soon as you've got omatidia there, they start producing the hedgehog, which starts producing this, you start getting the inhibitory feedback. And once you've kicked it off, you have this self-organizing system for establishing that pattern which leads to that uniform eye.
Maybe I would add something. Here I think that you have this spontaneous generation of those cluster of cells. But I think those cluster of cells also use a template of previous flow which already formed, which is not indicated here. I mean, you see that you preclude how the next cluster will form, but I think you have to realize that this cluster also comes in response to the cluster on the right, which has a two or three cells of atonal expression.
Sorry, you're saying that this one...
You know, where this group of cells, a big group of cells,
yes,
is forming here. It's forming here because of the cluster before. So basically, each row uses a template of previous row.
Well,
I think you say the same thing, but
Well, I think so, but I think that actually where this row is for, I mean, I think this is the symmetry breaking step here, actually. So this is the point where these cells are forced to turn off atonal, and these ones are not forced to turn off atonal because they're out of reach of this inhibitory zone. If I drew those as spheres, it might have been a bit clearer. As circles, that might have been a bit clearer. So I think this is actually the point at which the next row is, the spacing, the position of the next cluster is determined exactly here by the fact that it's at the furthest point from these two.
No, I think we're saying the same thing.
Okay.
I'm trying to say that you seem to create those big clusters of green cells magically.
No. On the contrary, they're not magic because they're directed by the preceding row.
You are saying the same thing.
We are saying the same thing. Okay, good.
I would like to see it simulated. Has anyone made a model?
No, not that I'm aware of.
But it's obvious for someone to make a model.
Well.
Is there cell death or cell motion?
There's no cell motion. There's very little.
But in refining this pattern.
That's an absolute fair point. Yes, there is a lot of sort of shuffling around that will actually produce this thing. I mean, as you exactly point out, this is not that in terms of regularity, but it lays down the bones of it, and I think everything else becomes a more trivial point of packing. Yeah, there is some, because actually what happens is there are too many cells produced in the eye. There are more cells produced in the eye than are actually needed. Not many more, but there's a kind of safety net number, and at the end of eye development those are killed, and at that point everything kind of tidies up and packs into the absolute sort of neat array that you ultimately see.
Did you look at size compensation?
No. Boris already asked me about that. We haven't done it, and I'm now keen to go back and do that.
But this is the diffusion, we have long
range. Yes, but we don't know what the factor is. No, it is definitely diffusible, but we don't know, but we have no idea what the factor is. And you know, we'd like to find that out, but we don't know.
Mobile cells, but I think this work for genetic mechanical deformation.
Of course.
Does that play a crucial role?
I don't know. I've never looked. There might be ways you could do that. The deformation is all in the going in and out of the screen. There's no deformation this way or this way or this way or this way. But whether the squeeze that they all squeeze down basally and whether that makes a difference, I actually don't know. It's an interesting notion, but I have no idea.
Does one ever see defects, for example, extra rolls of material surface?
You can produce defects by mutating various of these components. But in a normal eye, it is absolutely perfect, and you never see a mistake.
Can I ask a totally crazy theoretical physicist question?
Sure, I don't know if I'll answer it, but
it's totally crazy.
Yeah.
Probably
no.
This morning I had raspberry jam for breakfast, and I picture the raspberry.
It looks very like this.
Is that the same mechanism?
I think there must be something. I mean, I think there is a sort of attractiveness about packing spheres into hexagonal arrays.
So
well, the truth is, I have no idea how raspberries develop. I'm afraid at all. But I mean, I agree with you. It is very striking, and indeed, many Drosophila eye mutants are named after fruit things and you know strawberries and so on. I mean, they do look like that. I think it's maybe a packing issue more than anything else, rather than actually any kind of conserved mechanism. But I sure as hell wouldn't want to say, because I know nothing about raspberry development.
But it's just worth pointing out that certainly in plant development, the lateral inhibition of the kind, you know, where you put one thing inhibits you from making one too close, is very common in plants. I mean, that's, you know, about the pattern. And also in development, it's a fundamental mechanism.
It is a fundamental mechanism. It's why I wanted to illustrate it here, even in a slightly imperfect way. I mean, this isn't one of the cases where it's best understood, but I mean, it is very striking the eye, and I just wanted to sort of stick with the theme.
Can you produce defects at this level of packaging if
they go
away by the time you get
the
fully developed?
There does seem to be some ability to correct things, but by and large, if you introduce defects here, you see them all the way through, which is actually the basis for a lot of our genetic screens. Most of our screens are done just looking for adult eyes which look disrupted, and one then follows them back in development and find out where things start going wrong. But there is a tiny amount of ability to correct things, but not much. Okay. I'm going to tell you one last thing, and I'm going to do it fast. And it's going to be less conceptual and easier, I think. I just wanted to tell you about some more recent stuff which introduces a new mechanism for intercellular signaling. And I think, apart from just wanting to talk about some stuff that's a bit more recent, I think one or two things that people will be interested in. Remember, back to the old players, here's Spitz, the activating ligand, here's the receptor, and these two molecules, rhomboid, which I've talked about, and star, which I haven't talked about, both fulfill these criteria that I mentioned of being genetically defined as being A in this cell and B key for activating signaling. And the question is, how do they do it? And one of the models that's been around for a long time, and you will sort of have, it'd be kind of obvious based on the way we've been talking about it, is that somehow rhomboid and star may be involved in this proteolytic activation. And this was principally initially put forward by Benny Shelo, but it sort of became very rapidly a sort of common idea that this is how it works. There was no evidence to support this biochemically, and so we decided to go and look at this in a molecular and cellular way and see if we could figure out what rhomboid and star are doing, because it's kind of embarrassing having them as being the cardinal regulators but actually having no clue as to what they do. And they don't look like other molecules. There's no hint from looking at them what kind of protein they might be. We also noticed that rhomboids were actually conserved throughout evolution. Now, this is a weird list made several years ago, where I say things like elegans in one place and and rat in another. So this is not very scientific. But all I want to show is that here's elegans, here's rat, here's human, here's yeast, here are some bacteria, here are some plants, here are some archaea, here's dictyostelium. You name it, they have a rhomboid. So our sort of appetite for this was whetted, because we thought not only would we in one fell swoop solve EGF receptor signaling, but we would also understand the world. And so we decided that this was another good reason for going after this. This work, because this is slightly more experimental, let me just introduce Jeff Lee, Sin Urban, Angus McQuibben, and Ollie Lohi, who are the people who one time and another over the last few years have been involved in this project and have done it all. I'm really going to abbreviate this. I want to show you about two results and then the model. So the first result was whether we could get biochemical support for that model that I just showed you, and indeed they could. All they did was to express in cells, spits the ligand, plus or minus rhomboid or star, and see what happens. And so what we're looking at here is the protein, either in the medium from outside the cells or from the cells themselves. And all I really want to show you is that until you put it, if you put in rhomboid and star together with spits, you get a whopping great release of spits into the medium, into a diffusible, soluble form. So that gave us some biochemical support for the notion that these two molecules in some way are responsible for that proteolytic activation that I've been talking about of spits. So that was good, because that tells us that sort of this model is basically right. The other surprise we got was when we started looking at where these things were in the cells. And in a way, this illustrates one of the shortcomings of genetics. Genetics gives us sort of nice logical conceptual answers, but it doesn't necessarily tell you in a biochemical or cell biological sense really what's working, what's happening. So I've drawn all my pictures with everything on the plasma membrane of these cells, because it's simple to draw and it's kind of how we thought it was. Turns out that's completely wrong. So spits, the ligand, turns out to be completely limited and restricted to the endoplasmic reticulum, which is an earlier part of the secretory pathway. It doesn't make it out to the cell surface. It gets hung up in the ER if you express it in cells. And indeed, in flies, we know this is the case too. However, and then if you look at rhomboid, which we also drew on the cell surface, that also isn't right. Rhomboid turns out to be restricted to another part of the secretory pathway, the Golgi apparatus, which is beyond the ER but before you get to the cell surface. So immediately these proteins aren't even in the same compartment. If I show you star, it's a bit more boring because actually it's throughout the secretory pathway. It's in the ER, it's in the ER, it's in the Golgi, and it's in the plasma membrane. But the insight that Jeff Lee got was when he started co-expressing these proteins. And what he found was that here's spits again, restricted completely to the ER. It's totally co-localizing with an ER marker here. But if he co-expressed at the same time star, he found that spits was now driven through the secretory pathway. And I hope you can tell that this is now decorating the outside of this COS cell here. And you can see it on the plasma membrane. And indeed, you can sort of make out that it's in the Golgi apparatus too. And so what star did was to drive spits from an early part of the secretory pathway through the Golgi apparatus to the cell surface. And that made us completely rethink how the signaling was working. And this is basically how we now think it does work. So here is spits stuck in the ER on its own. It doesn't go beyond the ER for reasons which are not entirely clear about. Until it meets star, star takes it to the Golgi apparatus, where it meets rhomboid. Remember, rhomboid was only in the Golgi apparatus. Rhomboid somehow induces the cleavage of spits, which is then released into its soluble form and free to be secreted. Now, one of the things that tells you, which is kind of surprising and worth thinking about if you're wondering about control of signaling, is that the genetics told us that this is the key controller of EGF receptor activity. Now, the EGF receptor is somewhere over here on the side of, the other side of the lecture room. And yet, the key regulator of whether the receptor is active or not is really this step here of ER to Golgi transport in the signal-producing cell. And I think I was going to say it's counterintuitive. The more you think about it, actually, the more sense it makes. You don't want to start making dangerously active ligands if you're not going to use them. But it certainly was a kind of a surprise for us. And the last thing that this led to was the fact that we then were asked the question, well, what does rhomboid do? How does rhomboid actually do that? It turns out rhomboid is the prototype of a completely new family of proteases that had not been expected to exist before, which are the intramembrane serine proteases. And what's so surprising about them is, so serine proteases are one of the classical enzymes that people have worked on. They were the first enzyme whose structure and enzymatic mechanism was understood at an atomic level. And they're based around what's called the catalytic triad with an activated serine. What rhomboids turn out to be is a convergent evolution. So these are not derived from the serine proteases, but they are molecules that have produced the same solution, the same chemical solution to cleaving a peptide backbone by activating a serine with a catalytic triad. The other surprising thing is they actually cleave within a lipid bilayer, within a basically hydrophobic environment. Now, the cleavage reaction is a hydrolysis. You have to add water, and that is not usually expected to happen in a lipid bilayer. And the principle that I think is here is that this is actually a new and fairly widespread signaling mechanism, because it turns out there are two other classes of enzymes that are not dissimilar, but the site-2 proteases that control cholesterol metabolism in mammals and the presenilins that are involved in Alzheimer's disease. And they too are intramembrane proteases. They're not serine proteases, they're different classes. One is metalloproteases, one is an aspartyl protease. But what's been common to them, and until now, this mechanism has been seen as a way of sequestering transcription factors out of the nucleus. So in both cases, what they do is you have a membrane-tethered transcription factor, which is released by these proteases and free to move into the nucleus and activate transcription. What the rhomboids are is the first example of these proteins that actually release things outside the cell. And so this turns now into a much more general sort of signal transducing mechanism that can be used in a variety of different ways, either inside the cell here or outside the cell to produce signals. And I won't talk about it now except to say that amazingly enough, the same thing is true in bacteria, and that a rhomboid in bacteria is involved in releasing a signal but in intercellular signaling between bacteria, which is called quorum sensing. And I think that is where I will stop, except just to finish by saying that, I mean, what I hope I've convinced you is that A, the importance of intercellular signaling in controlling development, B, that feedback, both positive and negative, really play an important part in controlling that signaling, and that thirdly, that inductive signaling, as I've said so many times now, is not the poor relation of morphogen gradients, and that both can elaborate quite complex patterns.
Thank you.